Barely 1 month into his presidency, John F. Kennedy addressed the youth fitness program, and he said, "We do not want in the United States a nation of spectators. We want a nation of participants in the vigorous life." He might be shocked to know just how much a nation of spectators we have become. Just in the realm of sports, the total number of spectators in sporting events last year numbered 137.5 million people. And I don't think that counts NASCAR, which draws more than all the other sports combined, so you could probably double that number. If you add to that those who watch live sports on television, there's an estimated 88% of Americans watch sports on television or in person. I did some quick math. That comes out to 301 million people in our nation are spectators. Years ago, Bud Wilkinson was a famous college football coach, described a football game as 50,000 spectators desperately needing exercise, watching 22 men desperately needing rest. I think he got that right on the nail. And you can apply that to all the other sports as well. Sad to say, that same mentality has crept into many of the churches in America. This spectator mentality is present. Many churches are filled with people who come to worship services primarily to be entertained. They'll place their money in the basket. They might turn to the number of the song that's announced in the book. Maybe a few brave souls will sing. Now, I got to tell you, you guys sang very well today. If the pastor can keep their interest for 20 or 30 minutes, they might compliment him on the way out. Well, now you can do it all in the comfort of your living room, right? You can sit on the couch and watch church. And if you don't like the song, you can mute it. You don't like the sermon, you can change channels, right? It's so easy. It's a lot easier to sit back and watch others worship. It's what I call spectator spirituality. Entertained, but not involved. Now, we might think that's something new, but it's not. It actually goes back centuries before Christ. In the Old Testament, prophet Ezekiel chapter 33, God is speaking to the prophet, and he says this: "As for you, son of man, your countrymen are talking together about you by the walls and at the doors of the houses." Now, if God said that to me, I'd be thinking, uh-oh, right? What are they saying? But he says, they're saying to each other, "Come and hear the message that has come from the Lord." Well, that sounds pretty good, right? "My people come to you as they usually do, and they sit before you to listen to your words. But they do not put them into practice. With their mouths they express devotion, but their hearts are greedy with unjust gain. Indeed, to them you are nothing more than one who sings love songs with a beautiful voice or plays an instrument well, for they hear your words and do not put them into practice." Spectator spirituality. Oh, they come to church, as we would say it today. They love to hear the word preached. But it was little more than a sporting event or a concert or a movie at a theater. They come and they watch, and they walk away unchanged. Jesus does not call his disciples to be spectators. The invitation of Jesus is not about sitting on the sidelines, receiving all that God has freely given. It's about boldly stepping out into living our faith on a daily basis. Now, we have been seeing the invitations of Jesus in the word, come. Come as you are. Come follow me. Now, this morning, the invitation is just that word, come. But in the context of the story, I think there's a little more involved. And in the words of our call to worship this morning, I've entitled this message, come on, let's go. That's what Jesus is saying. Come on, let's go. Let's get involved. Let's do. I'd like you to turn to Matthew chapter 14. And you might say, well, that's not Luke and that's not Mark. I know what I'm doing this time. Matthew chapter 14. Yeah, there are just too many Gospels in there. Matthew chapter 14. Verse 22, we are first confronted with a storm of fear. How many of you are fearful with certain kind of storms? I am, I'll admit it. What kind of storm really bothers you? Is it a hurricane? Well, you're probably glad to live in Illinois. Is it a blizzard? We get a few of those. Tornado? We've had them by the score this year. For me, it's strong wind. Whether that's a tornado or straight line winds, really strong winds unnerve me. It just gets under my skin. I remember when I was in college, in the men's lounge, they had floor-to-ceiling windows, and they were about 12 feet tall. Huge panes of glass. And being out in the plains of Minnesota, the wind would just be whipping across. And I can remember standing in the men's dorm and watching those huge panes of glass bowing in because the wind was so strong. I'm thinking that thing could shatter at any moment. Thankfully, it never did. But that was just creepy to me. When you see the devastation that wind can do, and there's really no good place to hide, you know, there's nothing you can really do about it. Matthew 14 identifies a storm that blew up on the Sea of Galilee while the disciples were in a boat in the middle of it. Now, don't forget, the Gospels record that at least half of Jesus' 12 disciples were fishermen. They made their living on this body of water. They're used to the Sea of Galilee. They're used to the squalls that suddenly spring up. But here they are in the midst of a storm, and they're afraid. They're struggling to keep their boat upright and keep themselves from drowning. But there was something else that made them even more frightened. And we read about it starting in verse 22. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on the mountainside by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Here's the storm. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them, walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. The crowds had been around Jesus. He had been teaching them. He had fed 5,000. I'm sure he and his disciples were exhausted. He says, guys, go get in the boat. Go on across the bay. I'll catch up with you. And I'll dismiss the crowd, which he did. And then he went up into the mountains to pray. And he was there for a long time. Because the Gospels record that during the fourth watch of the night, he comes walking out on the water toward them. The fourth watch was between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. So this is what we would call the middle of the night. They'd been struggling for a while. And then in the darkness, maybe when lightning would flash, enabling them to see, they saw a form of something coming across the water. And the closer it got, the more it looked human. That would freak me out too, because that's not normal. And they're thinking, that's a ghost. But then they heard the voice of Jesus saying, "It is I, don't be afraid." Now that phrase, "it is I," seems very common to us. Doesn't sound all that exciting. But in the original Greek, it's the words "ego am I," which means "I am." This is the name of God that God gave to Moses back at the burning bush when Moses said, "Well, if they ask me what your name is, what am I supposed to tell them?" And he says, "You tell them, I am sent you." That's the word Jesus used here. I am. Declaring himself to be God. I am here. I am with you. That's why you can take courage. Not because the storm isn't raging. Not because you're not in danger, but because I am with you. Maybe you've never thought about this before, but do you know that the disciples were exactly where Jesus told them to be when this storm hit? He had instructed them to go across, and he would catch up to them. They were obedient. They were doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and they get caught up in this storm. Sometimes we as Christians think that if something goes wrong in life, it must be because we did something bad and God's after us. They were doing exactly what they were supposed to do, and the storm came up. Because our lives are not stormproof. As Christians, we're going to encounter storms all the time. That doesn't mean we've done something wrong or we deserve it. It could be you're exactly where God wants you to be. And Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." Why? Because I am here. Next, we see a part of the story that doesn't appear in Mark, nor does it appear in John's recording of this same incident. In verse 28, Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." Now, I want you to picture yourself as one of the other 11 disciples at this point. You're in a boat, it's in a storm, you're doing everything to keep it upright. You're tired, it's the middle of the night, you've been fighting this a long time. Yeah, you're probably a little bit scared. You may be soaked. And Peter pops off, "Hey, Lord, let me come out and walk on the water with you." What would your reaction be? His brother Andrew's probably saying, "Do it, do it, do it," right? "Do the world a favor and step out of the boat," right? James and John might have been there putting, "We're ready to push him out," right? And you know, there are some people that criticize Peter for this to this day. There are some classic commentators that say Peter had no business asking Jesus to come out and walk on the water. That's arrogant. That's pride. Guys like John Calvin and Matthew Henry criticize Peter for doing this. But then Jesus said, "Come." Peter says, "Hey, if that's you, let me come out with you," right? And if that were most of our kids, we'd like, "No, sit down in the boat." Jesus says, "Come." Or, the way I hear it, "Come on, let's go. Get out, Peter. Get out here on the waves. Walk with me. This is awesome. No one's ever done this before. I don't think Jesus was offended at all. I think he latched on to Peter's faith and said, come on, let's go. Come on out. I love the way Tony Evans puts it. Only Tony Evans could put it like this. He said, Peter decided he was better off with Jesus on the stormy water than he was hanging out in the boat with his homies. Yeah. Jesus recognized that and he said, come on. And that leads us to the step of faith in the rest of verse 29. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. Without hesitation, he gets over the side, steps out onto the water, and he starts walking out toward Jesus on top of the water. Step by step, he's making his way toward Jesus, just like he's walking on packed snow. He's just walking right out there. Now, most of you have heard that story, right? And my guess is your mind is already jumping ahead to the next verse where Peter, in the midst of his stroll, takes a look around and he hears the wind and he sees the waves and he's like, what am I doing out here? And bloop, he starts to sink, right? And Jesus catches him and says, oh, Peter, why did you doubt? That's usually where our minds go. I'm not going there today. I want to focus on the fact that Peter had the guts to get out of the boat and walk to Jesus on the water, to do what no one had ever done and to do what no one ever believed could happen. Peter did it. His faith carried him out of that boat. And that took a lot of courage. We usually think of faith as being confident in Christ, and it is. But faith is also courage in Christ. It's taking a step where we have no business going. It's doing the things that really don't make sense. It's getting out of the safety of where we are. Getting out of our chair or our couch or our pew from spectating and saying, I want to be in the game. That's the kind of faith that Peter had. I like the way Warren Wiersbe puts it. Faith is not believing in spite of the evidence. It's obeying in spite of the consequence. That's faith. Faith is not closing your eyes and holding your nose and just taking a blind leap into the unknown. It's saying, God, I'm going to do what you want me to do regardless of the cost. Because if you've called me to do it, that's where I need to be. Faith rivets its attention solely on the Master who says, come. And as long as Peter did that, he walked on the water. Still the only person ever to do that. Max Lucado says, faith is a desperate dive out of a sinking boat of human effort in a prayer that God will be there to pull us out of the water. Or as a Rich Mullins song puts it, you've got to get out of the boat if you claim to walk on water. This is true. Now, why is Matthew the only gospel that records this scene? Ever wondered that? I have. I mean, Matthew, Mark, and John all record Jesus walking on the water, but only Matthew records that Peter got out there too. Well, remember that Mark wrote his gospel primarily as Peter's protege. Simon Peter gave the information for Mark's gospel. And I imagine that at that point in his walk of faith, Peter had learned enough humility not to include his story when he was telling Mark. He didn't want to be promoting himself. That makes sense to me. Why would John not do it? Because John and Peter had a rivalry going. And if you don't believe it, read the account of the resurrection, where John mentions like four times that he outran Peter to the tomb, right? He wasn't about to give Peter props for something like this. I don't know. At any rate, Peter's step of faith conquered his fear. And fear is the greatest enemy of faith. Fear is what keeps us on the sidelines. Maybe it's fear of getting hurt. I'll give you an example. I wish I had thought of this earlier because I'd put a picture up on the screen that would prove what I'm saying to you is true. Because you're going to have to take this by faith. When I was in Bible college, I liked to play football. But only flag football. Because I liked to walk. I didn't want to get hit. But my junior year, they started an intercollegiate football team that had helmets and pads and the whole thing. Well, I didn't go out my junior year because I wasn't good enough. At least that's what I told myself. My senior year, enough guys said, come on, you got good hands, you can catch. Get out, we need you. So I was, okay, so I did it. I had the biggest shoulder pads you could find. Big old helmet. And my one goal, actually I had two goals. I wanted to score a touchdown. But even more than that, I wanted to walk off the field at the end of the season. Well, throughout the season, I never really got into many games. In fact, the coach would never put me in until we were losing by at least 50 points so that I couldn't lose the game, I guess. I still have my jersey 40 years later, and it is pristine. I never did score a touchdown. And at the end of the year, I was a little disappointed that I didn't play more than I did, but then I realized why. So I was afraid of getting hurt. So in practice, I was a little hesitant. I was worried more about my safety than I was completing the play. And I'm pretty sure that's why the coach didn't put me in. I think that's true of a lot of Christians as well. We're afraid of getting hurt. Or, what I think the greatest fear is, something called atychophobia. I did not make that up. It's the fear of failure. That's what gets most of us. Put in another way, the fear of looking stupid. Why I would never roller skate as a kid. Because it's not if you fall, it's when you fall, and I didn't want to look stupid. I didn't want people laughing at me, so the only way you don't fall skating is you don't skate. And to this day, I've never been on a pair of skates and not planning on to anytime soon. We're so afraid that we might fail, and let's face it, you're gonna fail. That we don't try. And if you don't want to fail, don't try. But if you don't try, you'll also never succeed. You'll never know what it's like to be used by God in a way that is so incredible. You'll sit on the sidelines. You'll sit in the pew. You'll spectate instead of participate. And life will pass you by. Theodore Roosevelt once said, "No great destiny ever came to a people who feared the future, who feared failure more than they hoped for success." A lot of truth in those words. On another occasion, he expanded on that theme. "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbled, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who who errs, who comes short again and again because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, who actually tries to do the deed, who knows great enthusiasm, the great devotion, and spends himself in a worthy cause, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy nor suffer much because they live in the gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat. I don't even know that he was a Christian, but we need to hear that. That's the kind of life Christ calls his disciples. When he says, come follow me, it's not come sit and watch. It's come follow me. Only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly. Now, did Peter fail in this venture? Yeah, eventually he did. He was human. He probably got farther than I would have. I'm not sure I'd have got out of the boat. But he can still be said as the only other person in history other than Jesus Christ who ever walked on water. He did it. Wasn't perfect, but it got into Scripture. And it's a great evidence of faith. That faith evidenced fearlessness. Maybe not totally absent of fear, but his faith conquered his fear. And that's what needs to happen. Sure, he's been criticized. I rather admire him. Even though it wasn't perfect, it's a whole lot better than most of us. The first time I'd ever heard this passage from this perspective was a personal testimony by a man who was called into full-time Christian ministry. At this time, he was in the business world. He had a good-paying, secure job. But he recounts how a Christian friend came to him and said, I was praying the other day and God gave me a message for you. He says, I'm a little skeptical about God giving somebody else a message for me, but he said, I guess I wasn't listening, so he had to tell somebody who was. His friend reminded him of this very passage that we're talking about today. And he admits that, as his friend's telling the story, his mind raced ahead to Peter sinking down and, you know, Jesus had to rescue him. But that wasn't what he had in mind at all. He said, do you realize that Peter was the only disciple to get out of the boat? There were 11 disciples that were sitting in a warm, safe, dry, comfortable boat. Only Peter had enough faith to get out and walk to Jesus in the storm. That friend went on to say, Dana, right there at your desk, you're sitting in your boat and it's safe. And it's dry, and it's comfortable. But you need to be walking in the storm with Jesus. And from that moment on, he committed his life to full-time ministry, reaching out to others in the message of Christ. And he concluded with these words, and I quote, "It is not because I'm some kind of spiritual giant, but I can tell you this, there is more peace and more happiness in the storm with Jesus than there is in the boat alone." So I ask you this morning, where are you? Are you sitting where it's safe and comfortable, afraid of failure, just trying to hang on, watching everybody else do? Jesus is walking in the midst of your storm, and he is inviting you to join him. Are you willing to step out of your boat and walk to Jesus in the storm? That testimony I mentioned a few moments ago ended with a chorus that we're going to end our service with today. It's a very simple chorus that has a tremendous meaning if we mean it. And it says simply, I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. So, in the words of our call to worship, come on, let's go.